Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
In this new flexible world of work, we're all looking for ways to work better, smarter, and faster. With SAP Concur Solutions, you can automate your travel, expenses, and invoices into one connected workflow for an easy way to manage company costs. See every penny of spending, even before it's spent, and keep the process moving with handy apps, so your team can work from anywhere. Move your business forward with SAP Concur Solutions. Visit concur.com to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 8th of August, these are our main stories. The US says it believes there's still a window of opportunity to resolve the crisis in Niger as the West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS, agrees to meet on Thursday. A senior Israeli military official describes attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank as a form of terrorism. Donald Trump's lawyers have opposed an attempt to limit what information he can make public about the prosecution on charges of trying to overturn the 2020 election. Also in this podcast, Ukraine's security forces say they've discovered another plot to assassinate President Zelensky. And the film The Exorcist caused controversy when it was released in 1973.
Some critics called the movie a masterpiece. Others branded it a monstrosity.
Now its director, William Friedkin, has died at the age of 87. We look back on his life. West African leaders will hold another emergency summit on the crisis in Niger after the country's new military rulers defied an ultimatum to restore the elected government. The regional bloc, ECOWAS, had threatened possible military intervention if the army didn't reinstate President Mohamed Bazoum by midnight on Sunday. Speaking on Monday, the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said he'd been in touch with Niger's deposed president and reiterated his call for the democratically elected government to be reinstated.
We strongly support the work that ECOWAS is doing to try to help restore the constitutional order. In Niger, I've been in close touch with President Bazoum, with many colleagues in the region, including the Nigerian President Tinubu, colleagues at the African Union. And it's very important that that constitutional order be restored. And right now, I think ECOWAS is playing a very important role in moving the country back in that direction.
Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton, told me more about what Washington had to say.
They've held talks still urging the military junta to step aside, and they say there is still a window of opportunity for a diplomatic solution. They said they've suspended more than $100 million of aid. And earlier, Mali and Burkina Faso said they were sending a delegation from their countries to Niamey, the capital of Niger, in support of the junta. The coup leaders had closed the airspace above Niger, anticipating some sort of military intervention. And a flight tracking software showed a transport plane going from Ouagadougou, the capital of Burkina Faso, to Niamey, hours after airspace was closed. I think it has to be said that the regional bloc has not played its hand particularly well. They had this very, very tough talking ultimatum with a very strong threat. And there was a huge build-up to this deadline on Sunday night, where we were expecting some sort of military intervention. And then since that deadline passed, there was just a deafening silence. And now they say they will hold a meeting on Thursday, which doesn't suggest a lot of urgency. It's sort of a bit like, if in doubt, what do you do? Well, we'll hold another meeting. And it all implies that perhaps they played their cards a bit too early and they don't sort of have any leverage anymore. And I think ECOWAS was taken by surprise by the coup in the first place. And it's complicated by the fact that about a million Nigerian refugees are in Niger and they're really ethnically the same. So Nigeria doesn't want to send in troops against their own kin. So it's all a bit of a mess.
Richard Hamilton. Well, Paul Melly is a journalist and consulting fellow on the Africa programme at the Chatham House think tank here in London. Gary O'Donoghue asked him whether the junta will take the passing of the deadline without any obvious action as a sign that ECOWAS has lost its nerve.
I don't think so, unless they're very stupid. It's fairly obvious that ECOWAS needed to set a fairly tight initial deadline just to get momentum, because in handling the other crises where there have been coups before in West Africa over the last 3 years, the clock has been run down, if you like. They've let a longer period of time elapsed before really negotiating. And I think their conclusion was they needed to take a much tougher line with Niger. And I imagine that the junta will have understood that. So I don't think the junta will think that ECOWAS is backing off. In fact, with the sanctions biting hard and various West African governments announcing troops that are assigned to the force, they will know it's a serious threat. But that doesn't mean that they will cave in.
ECOWAS is getting together in Abuja on Thursday. What do you think their next steps will be?
I think they will first take stock of the impact of sanctions. Niger is a landlocked country, and most of its trade flows down to the West Africa coast, and most of the country's imports come in through Nigeria and Benin. So that leaves it very trade exposed. And it's also part of the CFA franc West African single currency bloc, whose central bank is actually in Senegal. So ECOWAS and the allied monetary bloc have the clout to apply some really serious economic pressure. And we're already seeing prices going up. So they will first of all want to see what impact that economic message is having. And they want to demonstrate to their own publics that they are giving negotiation a chance. I would be quite surprised if they moved instantly to decide on force after Thursday.
I mean, they can't really decide on force because some of their members are simply against it, aren't they?
The way ECOWAS operates, the countries that currently have military regimes, their membership is effectively suspended. So Mali, Guinea and Burkina Faso, in a sense, don't have a say in this decision.
Paul Melly. As we record this podcast, a senior American diplomat says she's held frank and difficult discussions with the military junta in Niger. Victoria Nuland, who's the acting Deputy Secretary of State, said the coup leaders hadn't agreed to restore the democratic order and didn't let her meet the deposed president, Mohamed Bazoum. Speaking from the capital of Niger, Niamey, Ms. Nuland added that Niger's coup leaders understood the risks of working with the Russian mercenary group Wagner, which is active in neighbouring countries. The Israeli military chief spokesman has described violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank as terrorism. He also linked it to a rise in attacks by Palestinians. His comments echo those reportedly made by the head of Israel's Internal Security Service, which have been denounced by some far-right politicians in the Israeli government. Here's our Middle East correspondent, Yolan Nell.
In a round of interviews on Israeli media, the army's top spokesman addressed a weekend of violence in the West Bank and Israel. On Friday, a young Palestinian man was killed in an attack by armed settlers on a village near Ramallah. And the next day, a Palestinian fatally shot a security guard in Tel Aviv before another guard shot him dead. Yesterday, Israeli forces killed three Palestinians in Jenin, who were said to have been planning an attack. Speaking to the Ynet news site, Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari strengthened his usual language to describe settler violence as terrorism, and he said it was pushing Palestinians into what he called terror too.
Nationalist crime and nationalist terror is terror. I don't have any other way to say it. It pushes civilians who are not involved in terror in the Palestinian Authority to terror.
Those remarks echo a warning that was reportedly given by the head of Israel's Internal Security Service to the Prime Minister before Friday's deadly incidents. Far-right members of the governing coalition then accused him of being a leftist and unable to distinguish between the enemy and his own people, prompting the Prime Minister to voice his support for his security official. There's been growing international concern about a recent rise in violence by extremist settlers under Israel's hardline government, with the US also labelling Friday's attack as terrorism.
Yoland Nell. The former US President Donald Trump and his lawyers had until Monday evening to respond to a request for a court order banning any evidence sharing about the federal case he faces on overturning the election result in the 2020 election. Before the legal response, Mr. Trump tried to turn the tables on prosecutor Jack Smith by posting that it was Mr. Smith who was deranged and needed a protective order to stop him from leaking stories. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes told me what happened.
Mr. Trump and his team met the deadline, which was to respond to the initial request by the prosecution, the request to the judge for this protective order, restricting the use of the evidence during this phase of the case, which is known as the discovery phase. The evidence is being shared between the prosecution and the defence. That happens in every criminal trial. It gives the defence an opportunity to see what the specific information is that the prosecution is going to take to court, and it gives them time to prepare. In this specific case, the request is that Donald Trump shouldn't be allowed to go on social media and reveal what that evidence is. He can't talk about it in television interviews or make a speech about it at one of his many rallies. The reason that the prosecution is asking for this is that this is very detailed. There's a substantial amount of information, and there is a concern that it could intimidate some witnesses who are likely to be called to the court whenever the trial is in a few months' time. And the release of this information now could affect them. And of course, there was that social media post just a few days ago by Mr. Trump: "If you go after me, I'm coming after you." His defense team have argued that, in fact, that was not meant to be in relation to the case. He was talking about something else. It is typical of Donald Trump to attack, using name-calling, his opponents. And I think it is likely to come as no surprise to Jack Smith or indeed any others on his team that Donald Trump, if he is legally allowed to, is likely to continue with this kind of language.
Peter Bowes. The Taliban in Afghanistan has banned girls who are more than 10 years old from attending school. Since the Taliban regained power in 2021, girls and women have been banned from amusement parks, public baths, gyms and sports clubs. Women are also not allowed to work in NGO offices or go to university. And last month, the Taliban ordered the closure of all beauty salons. The international community has widely condemned the severe limits being imposed on the rights of women and girls. Davina Gupta asked former member of the Afghan parliament, Shukriya Barakzai, what she thought about this latest development.
I'm not surprised, because the brutality of the Taliban was clear. When they was ruling Afghanistan from 1995 till 2001, they totally banned the schools for the girls. Not even the primary students, the girl was not able to go. Day by day, Taliban are really showing their true color, despite of all the international pressure and despite of the Doha agreement that they've signed, and they accept assaults of human rights. It shows how Taliban could go more far to eliminate and erase women from every single aspect of life. It is very sad to see the international community also. They are still keeping their engagement with the Taliban.
Shukriya, do you feel that a lot of times then women's rights are sort of used as a bargaining tool also by the Taliban with the international community?
This is what's the problem, because as long as the international community asking change on the policy of Taliban, Taliban are abandoning and crossing more lines in terms of women's rights issue. Not only they didn't allowing girls from the years 3 or according to their school with the age of 10, they say even physically, if some girls, even if they are not even 10 years or above 10, if physically they look bigger, they are not allowed to go. The number of forced marriages and child marriages had been increased. If you see their policy from August 15, 2021 till August 2023, day by day they were bargaining, the international community asking for women's rights and human rights, and the Taliban banned the women's rights. And this is the women of Afghanistan, we are the one to pay the price. The moderate Taliban are not the moderate, the less conservative Taliban are not that powerful to change their policy, even where the area they're more in power. So even over there we cannot see a different type of approach of Taliban towards women. I think this is the tool they are really like to chasing more international community under the name of moderate Taliban. Their policy towards women is exactly the same. If you see how many of them are joining the polygamy and taking second, third, even fourth wife in the last 2 years, you will say there's no sign of a moderate Taliban. I cannot see any sign of political will among the Taliban to change their policy, their behavior, and their rule and regulation towards women.
Shukriya Baraksai speaking to Divina Gupta. How to deal with asylum seekers is an issue facing many countries, not least in the UK, where political parties, charities and voters are split on what to do. On Monday, a floating barge that will house hundreds of migrants officially opened off the south coast of England. The government says it'll be cheaper than putting asylum seekers in hotels while their applications are decided. But campaigners have described the conditions on board as inhumane. Dan Johnson is in Portland in the southern English county of Dorset, where the barge is.
The first few men walked up the ramp and boarded this vessel, marking a new moment in how we welcome those who reach these shores seeking asylum. They've been moved from hotels as part of the government's determination to reduce accommodation bills and deter dangerous channel crossings. Cheryl Avery's director for asylum accommodation at the Home Office.
So we successfully onboarded the first cohort today, and there are 15 people on board. We have had a few challenges, but this is part of an ongoing structured process to bring up to 500 people on board. There have been some minor legal challenges, and I can't go into the detail of those, but accommodation is offered to all individuals on a no-choice basis.
Say it loud! Say it clear!
Refugees are welcome!
There's been huge opposition in this community and beyond. But today, protesters from Stand Up to Racism in Dorset were here to welcome the asylum seekers and hand them care packages, even though they're against this form of accommodation.
We wanted to show we cared. We wanted to show that there is support from the local community, and we partly wanted to help them, give them some things they might need.
We have to welcome them. They're here. They'll be here now. We have to welcome them.
But listen to Ian Broadhurst.
This is my home. This is my island.
Who came to challenge those perspectives.
This isn't being racist. This is just us saying we need to look after ourselves. They've got ensuite showers, getting free cooked meals a day. Really, they're living like kings.
This vessel's been weighed down with debate and beset by delays. Ministers say it's safe, but after a refit to double its capacity, there are concerns about fire safety. The Fire Brigades Union labelled it a death trap. Carolyn Parks is the Labour Mayor of Portland.
We need to remember that these are human beings and they have dreams and aspirations just like everybody else.
The hotel bills are enormous. Is it not right to try to tackle this?
The way to tackle something like that is to prevent it, and the way to prevent that is to invest properly in the asylum and immigration system.
20 asylum seekers are refusing to move here, fearful of what conditions may be like on board when it reaches its full capacity of 500 men.
Dan Johnson. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
The women's game is closing. The gap is closing between the top teams, and teams are not traditionally seen as one of the strong teams.
Why the underdogs have booted out some of the favourites in the Football Women's World Cup. In Ukraine, the security service says it's detained a woman for allegedly being involved in a plot to assassinate President Zelensky while on a visit to the southern Mykolaiv region. At the start of the war, Mr. Zelensky said he was aware that Russia's President Putin wanted him dead. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian president says his country is well within its rights to respond if Russia continues to dominate ports and launch missiles in the Black Sea. I spoke to James Waterhouse, who's in Kyiv.
This is quite a tale. They allege that this woman shared information with Russia, which allowed invading forces to plan an airstrike around President Zelensky's visit to the southern Mykolaiv region at the end of July, and that they stepped in after monitoring her for several weeks, where they alleged that she would travel the area, take pictures of different sites that would potentially give away locations of what they call Ukrainian electronic warfare systems, so presumably radars and missiles areas, for example, as well as ammunition depots. And she would go around, take images packages and send them to her Russian handlers several times. And not just that, this woman reportedly worked in the military shop on one of the Ukrainian army bases in the region. But I think what this also does is serve as a reminder of the risks that President Zelensky faces when he travels across the vastness of Ukraine. It's always been important to him to appear in different cities as well as being close to the front line.
And how many threats is he facing, do you think?
I think it's more of a constant threat. What the security services are telling us is that they have stopped around 12 to 13 direct assassination attempts, but they don't say over what timeline. This does remind me of the early days of the invasion when Russia firmly had Kyiv in its sights and there were reported attempts on the presidential palace. What they did at one point hope to do was topple the administration and install their own puppet. That has not happened, which is why President Zelensky remains target number one for Moscow. Wherever he goes, he has a heavy detail with him. Trips are often unannounced or short notice. It's quite the operation, but he still sets out to do this.
And he has been talking, hasn't he, about Ukraine being well within its rights to respond in kind if Russia continues to dominate in the Black Sea.
What Ukraine is trying to do is they're trying to create a distinction, because what they've said is, look, targets or threats in our occupied territories or the Black Sea are fair game. It is within our rights to take those out in the continued defence of our country. But that clearly stretches to coastal Russian cities like Novorossiysk, major terminals for Moscow, which was hit by a sea drone this week, where Ukraine is less keen to admit responsibility. Are the increased drone strikes we are seeing not just on border locations, but deeper and inside Moscow itself? There's been evidence in the past that Ukraine is behind it. There are several incidents where you don't know for sure, but this war's footprint is getting bigger, and I suspect that Western allies, who've long been nervous about a further escalation, it's either Ukraine ignoring those concerns or Western allies becoming more relaxed with the idea of Ukraine looking to destabilise Russia in this way.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. 6 months on from the devastating earthquake that hit Turkey and Syria, hundreds of thousands of people are still displaced. Just days after the disaster struck in February, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan vowed to rebuild the region within a year. While progress has been made in Hatay, one of the hardest hit provinces, the damage has been so vast that improvements have been slow to materialise. Victoria Craig reports from Antakya in southern Turkey.
Muharram Çayırca is pounding a mixture of broad beans and tahini to make a regional version of hummus for a customer. His business was destroyed in February's earthquakes, so he set up a temporary shop in a container outfitted with a kitchen, prep counters, even a dine-in area with tables and chairs amid the rubble.
We didn't receive any help or support from anyone. The municipality only allocated a place for us. Me and my brothers, we took the responsibility for equipping and furnishing the place ourselves.
He lost 22 relatives in the earthquake. His family owned a butcher, a bakery, and a meze restaurant serving traditional small plates, like the broad bean hummus he's preparing. After the disaster, Muharrem and his brothers decided to pour their savings into getting themselves back up and running.
Initially, we faced a water shortage. In the beginning, we used the generator for electricity during the day. Later on, we managed to connect directly to the electric lines. The authorities helped us with electricity and water supply.
Back in February, President Erdogan promised the city would go back to normal in a year. But 6 months on, there's still a long way to go. Antakya was ravaged by the natural disaster, and while determined businesses like Muharrem's have risen from the rubble, the cleanup operation is still a day and night process. The sound of digging machines scooping up tangles of metal and concrete is everywhere. Huge lots where buildings once stood shoulder to shoulder are now eerily empty, while in other places, structures marked for demolition still stand cross-sectioned, with kitchens, living rooms, and bedrooms still visible from the street. Some 164,000 people are still living in tents and containers in this province. Nearly 4,000 businesses operate in temporary structures.
Right now, our main focus is to revive trade, industry, and support small businesses.
This is Hussein Yaiman, a member of parliament from Hatay, who serves in President Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, or AKP.
Because if the economy revives, trade thrives, and life gets back on track, then people's lives will improve.
Back at Muharrem's shop, he tells me the most immediate need is the demolition of the damaged buildings so reconstruction can finally begin.
It will be like the first piece of a line of dominoes. If trade starts in the market and the market's formation strengthens, and if the support for small business is further reinforced by our government, we believe that the recovery will be faster.
Like many in this container shop community, Muharrem says the hardest part is drumming up business since tens of thousands of people fled the area after the earthquakes. But he says he's thankful for his life and livelihood, and he'll leave the rest to God and the municipality.
Victoria Craig. People in Haiti have been expressing skepticism about a recent offer from Kenya to lead a multinational force to help address brutal gang violence in the country, which has displaced tens of thousands. Nairobi offered 1,000 police officers in response to a call by Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry for international support. But local perceptions of Kenya's rights record are causing worry about its capacity to restore security in Haiti. Dr. Jean Bouto is a university professor in the capital, Port-au-Prince.
There are two things that we should consider. It is first the fact that the government has requested that intervention. At that time, it was not about Kenya. Probably the government was thinking about some kind of coalition with very big countries like United States, Canada, and maybe some countries in Europe. Whatever country, it would not have been welcome in terms of human rights issues. With all due respect for people from Kenya, Kenya's police forces and armed forces are not good examples. This is how we feel in general in Haiti. There are many other steps that should have been taken before thinking about intervention. The main issue is that neither the international community and the Haitian government do not want to make the proper steps that would be facing the political situation. We are facing a political crisis. There is a crisis of succession. So when Mr. Jovenel Moïse died, in any other situation, we probably would have a smooth or normal succession. That did not happen because all the institutional infrastructures in Haiti were dismantled. We do not have to accept that the political issue must continue the way it is. If the Kenyan forces do not come, of course, we are going to be probably facing uncertainty every day. When I go out, I do not know what can happen in the next corner. And my kids are not living here for the moment. But it doesn't mean that it must be that way.
Dr. Jean Bouto. In the last 16 in the Football Women's World Cup, the co-hosts Australia are through to the quarterfinals after beating Denmark 2-0. England squeaked through 4-2 on penalties after a well-organised Nigerian team challenged the Lionesses in a match that saw the England player Lauren James getting a red card. In more kickoff games on Tuesday, Colombia will take on Jamaica and France hopes to beat Morocco. Our sports reporter Mimi Fawaz has been following the action and she told me first that Nigeria had been unlucky to lose to England.
Nigeria were very unlucky to lose the match. They were the better side in the game against England. They were very solid defensively. Even in attack, Nigeria had more shots on target and they came close to leading a few times in the match. But unfortunately for England as well, Lauren James was sent off. Nigeria were very good at keeping her quiet in the game. The midfielders did a very good job in that side of things. She, of course, picked up that red card, stamping on the Nigerian defender's back. That caused a lot of people quite upset on social media, and that was the right call. But Nigeria overall were just so unlucky.
So we have matches ahead. What's your thinking about those?
Now, I think Morocco could possibly spring up an upset tomorrow against France. Of all the African teams that have went through to the last 16, three African teams for the first time in history, Morocco, the ones who really have responded well, especially losing in that first match, 6-0 against Germany. They will be playing France, an exciting match to watch out for tomorrow. And as well, Japan, they're playing on Friday, and they are looking very good in this competition.
And of course, we've got Colombia, Jamaica too. And what is striking you, Mimi, is it that a lot of these teams that were underdogs are actually really playing out their skins?
Now, I tweeted something earlier on today. I said, if only there's proper infrastructure in place, support, no pay disputes, professionalizing the leagues. And I put that, I guess you could say, to Africa, because I'm African. So I looked at the women's game in Africa. But you could also look at that beyond. You can see how the gap is closing between the so-called favorites, the big teams, and teams that people traditionally have looked at, smaller teams. You can see that gap closing. And that gap is closing with not the same infrastructure and facilities that we see in the West. So the been, I think, a wake-up call for many federations to see countries like, for example, Jamaica crowdfunding to come in and seeing how well they're doing in the competition through to the last 16 for the first time in their history. Seeing as well Nigeria with pay disputes, South Africa with pay disputes coming through to the last 16. You can only imagine now that the women's game is closing. The gap is closing between the top teams and teams are not traditionally seen as one of the strong teams.
Mimi Fawaz. The acclaimed film director, producer and screenwriter William Friedkin has died. He was 87. A member of the new Hollywood movement, he was most famous for films such as The French Connection and The Exorcist. Terry Egan looks back at his life.
There was no more terrifying film in the early 1970s than the one with which that music, Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells, came to be associated. It was the horror film The Exorcist, directed by William Friedkin, who was part of the new Hollywood movement of exciting young directors such as Francis Ford Coppola. But with tales of viewers fainting in the cinemas, and because of the subject matter, dealing as it does with the possession of a young girl whose head at one point turns 180 degrees, it earned Friedkin a notoriety beyond any he'd had so far. And yet Friedkin was already one of Hollywood's best-known directors. A couple of years earlier, he'd directed Gene Hackman in The French Connection. And that film, about a cop as ruthless as the drug dealers he's trying to find, but always thwarted in his pursuit, not least during a riveting car chase, had won 5 Academy Awards.
Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie? Huh? Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie?
Hey, man, come on, give me a break. Hey, I don't know what you're talking about.
Let me hear you say it. Come on. Have you ever been to Poughkeepsie? You've been to Poughkeepsie, haven't you? I want to hear it! Come on! Yes!
Brought up in Chicago in the United States, Friedkin began his career in television and with documentaries, directing one of the last episodes of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour. And once he got to The French Connection, his work on documentaries really told, enabling him to imbue the film with a bleak reality that set its tone. After The Exorcist came a short-lived production company set up with other famous directors that he himself left, and then more films, not nearly so successful. An expensive remake of a French classic, The Wages of Fear, called Sorcerer, was dramatically overshadowed at the box office by Star Wars in 1977, and the fortunes of his later work were equally overshadowed by the success of that film about an innocent young girl disturbingly manipulated by the devil, which was nevertheless nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director.
Terry Egan on the director, William Friedkin, who's died at the age of 87. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
If you're listening to this podcast, you must recognize the value of asking questions. At Aramco, our questions help us engineer a better future. How can today's resources fuel our shared tomorrow? How can we deliver energy to a world that can't stop? How can we deliver one of the fuels of the future? How can we sow curiosity to harvest ingenuity? To learn more about how innovation drives us forward, visit aramco.com/poweredbyhow.
Uncap your awe with St. Ives and discover the bright side of skincare. With exfoliating facial scrubs, oh yeah, Lush body wash, mm-hmm, for that oh-so-clean feeling. And all the things you love, like juicy apricots, shea butter, crushed rose petals. Yes, yes, and yes. For gorgeously radiant skin, it's St. Ives all the way. Click the banner to buy online now.